QSO Today, episode 483, William Thomas, WT0DX. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. I want to thank the following new listener sponsors this week: Matt Chenoweth, KE0IAT, Steve Schwarm, W3EVE. I also want to thank Donald Perriot, KE2BUN, for his $25 donation. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. William Thomas, WT0DX, was inspired by an early interest in electronics, amateur radio, and building Heath kits to spend a career as an engineer and inventor with over 150 patents in electronics and ultimately the cable television industry, where he was given the Cable TV Pioneer Award by the National Cable Television Association. Bill is the co-inventor of the interactive program guide still found on most cable television systems. Now retired, WT0DX spends his time giving back to amateur radio through mentoring, contributing, and testing, and he is my QSO today. WT0DX, this is Eric 4Z1UG. Are you there, Bill?
Yes, hi, 4Z1UG, this is WT0DX.
Bill, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
So I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. Was in high school in the late 1960s. And there was kind of a pirate radio underground that was going on in the Cleveland, Ohio area at that time. And I met some of the people, and I even maybe transmitted a few times myself. Quickly decided I really didn't want to be involved with that. And a high school friend of mine and I decided that we were going to get our ham licenses.
It seems to me that you already must have had some interest in radio and electronics before this, if you were following the pirates.
Yeah, I was, and I can't say exactly when, but I got interested in electronics. My dad was a mechanical engineer, so he was, you know, engineering oriented. But I got interested in electronics. You know, I built Heath kits, of course, and things like, you know, a stereo amplifier. I built some Heath kit test equipment. You know, might have even built a radio, one of the Heath kit radios at one point.
This was pre-high school?
This was probably, yeah, middle school into high school.
He gave you a lot of support.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very fortunate. They were able to, you know, buy me some of these kits and get me equipped and things.
Did he have a garage full of tools? Did you acquire tools or did he have tools?
You know, I don't remember, except I do remember that my workshop and ham shack was actually up on the second floor of our house in what would have been a bedroom. So I was not out in the garage. I was, you know, in the house, nice and warm and very comfortable.
So you had this predisposition towards electronics. What I think is interesting is, can you explain a little bit about, for the listeners, because I don't know whether there's a lot of pirate radio anymore, but what pirate radio was in those days in Cleveland?
Yeah, so it was local, I'm going to say youth, you know, maybe some in their upper teens, maybe even early 20s. And they used World War II surplus transmitter equipment, like ARC 5 transmitters that put out maybe 100 watts. And they would connect them to a long wire antenna, and they would tune them to somewhere in the broadcast, AM broadcast band, typically maybe just above the very top of the band where most radios could tune, but there weren't any other stations on the air. And they would broadcast popular music, rock and roll music. They'd have, you know, EJs. One of the stations I visited had what looked like, a radio station studio in the basement. They spent a lot of time and effort putting all this equipment together and broadcasting to the neighborhoods. And it was AM radio, so, it went for miles and miles.
A lot of vinyl on their shelves?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was all vinyl.
Were these album stations?
The ones that had money, they would have the latest 45s they'd be playing. It was, again, more like AM radio and less like FM radio.
I remember that as a kid as well in Orange County. Some of these guys actually transmitted quite a lot of power.
Yeah, and the FCC, they had FCC field officers at the time, and they would come around and they would shut these stations down, with the force of the government behind them.
So you and a friend decide in high school then to get an amateur radio license. Did your high school have an amateur radio club?
No, it did not. And if you ask me, did we find a local ham club and, have mentors? I actually don't remember that. I don't have a strong memory of there being a specific mentor. There were some hams that lived, a bicycle's drive from my house. And I went over and visited them and saw their stations and, hoped that someday I could have something as cool as they had. But I don't remember having a particular mentor. I think it was more the buddy system. Me and my friend, we kind of worked each other into getting our novice licenses and then, getting our general license. And I have an interesting memory about getting my general license. So you had to go downtown Cleveland to the federal building. You had to go up to the top floor where the FCC held the general license exams. And I was maybe 17, 18 years old. So I went down there. I get up to where the exam's being held, and there's all these guys standing in front of the room smoking cigarettes like mad. They were so nervous about going in front of the mean FCC examiners and taking their license exams.
Were they taking the general class license, or do you think they maybe were taking the commercial licenses?
I think this was ham. When I was there, I think it was all ham radio because, they did the Morse code thing and, written exams and whatnot. And then, of course, after that, I got my advanced class license, which I held for most of my ham radio career, got my extra maybe like 5 years ago.
So what year do you think you got your novice license?
I actually did some research because I couldn't quite remember, but it was 1968.
That's when you got your novice. And do you remember what the novice call sign was?
Absolutely. It was WN8AVH. And then I guess within a year, because you had to advance your class within a year, I got the general class, passed that exam, and it was WB8AVH. And I held that call until I went to college at Purdue University when I got another call, WB9KPT.
Your first station, was that a shared project with your friend, or did you have your own first station?
I had my own equipment. I distinctly remember building a Heathkit DX100 transmitter, 100-watt AM and CW transmitter. That thing was a monster. It probably weighed 50 pounds, if not more.
What was the receiver? And did you have that first? Were you like doing some shortwave listening before you got the license?
I think it was probably a Drake 2B receiver, which was, a lovely receiver in its era.
It's a lovely receiver in this era, is my understanding.
It is. In fact, I think I still own one somewhere back in my closet.
We want to touch on that as well, but did ham radio then play a part in the choices that you made for your career in education? It seems like it might have.
Well, I think it continued and strengthened my interest in electronics and engineering because after I graduated from high school, I went to Purdue University in Indiana and got a double E degree and ended up getting a master's in double E also. So I was very, very much the engineering type.
Why did you get the master's? And did you get it right away or did you go out and work?
It turned out that Purdue had a special 5-year program for getting your undergraduate and your graduate degree. And so for, you know, just the extra year, I was able to finish off and get my master's degree. I did work some summers. One of my summer jobs, we may talk about it later, was I worked at Zenith Electronics, the TV manufacturer in Chicago. I worked in their advanced development department. So I got to, as a summer job, I got to work with some very cool guys, you know, designing TVs.
Did you have an emphasis in your master's?
I did. It was what they called communications technology. So, you know, theory about communications. And actually, for my master's project, I built a set of laboratory equipment that let you run various kind of communications experiments. And they used that equipment, made clones of it, and used it for many years in their labs. So I was doing, you know, circuit design and everything else around all of that.
Your first job out of Purdue?
Well, the first job, actually, I went out to Silicon Valley and worked for a company because I had this communications degree. So I worked for a company, it was called ESL Incorporated, and they basically, everything they did was, let me call it government projects. And in fact, the project I had, which at the time, you know, was secret, et cetera, was they had built a computer model database of all the RF sources in the entire world. So imagine you're up in the sky somewhere and you're looking around, and this database would tell you what RF sources you're likely to see, you know, line of sight from that particular location in the globe.
When you say RF sources, that could be anything. That could be all the broadcast. It could be transponders, buoys.
That's right. But it was anything that was terrestrial. Jamming signals, all kinds of stuff like that. In fact, it was interesting because they did, this project was secret, but not top secret, right? My boss worked on top secret projects. I was there for about a year and a half. I never saw his office because his office was behind two sets of security doors. And he told me that every night he had to roll his file cabinet into a safe and lock it up.
In the days when people had file cabinets.
Yeah. And I decided I wanted to get back into the commercial. After working at Zenith, I wanted to get back into the commercial or consumer, you know, business world. I really appreciated all the kind of work that was going on at this company and other companies like us, you know, to protect us, right? But I said, it's not for me. It's really not for me. I'm more of a consumer electronics TV guy. So I actually left and went to work full-time at Zenith at that point.
You were there as a design engineer?
I was in the advanced development lab, and we worked on a number of interesting projects. The first one I worked on, so back in the analog TV days, you would often get ghosting images on the screen of your TV, reflections, right? You try to turn your antenna and, you know, might or might not get rid of them. So we were working on an automatic ghost canceling system that used one of these CCD type filters, and it would, you know, you'd write algorithms and it would try to cancel out the ghosts. We actually wrote a paper about that and won an IEEE award for that paper. It never got into commercial deployment, probably because of cost and, you know, and other things. But it was actually my introduction to using microprocessors to control stuff.
But ghosting images, wasn't that a result of multipath?
It was. It was due to multipath. And again, with the appropriate filtering technology in theory, you could cancel those ghosts.
There was a period of time I remember, maybe it was the late 60s, early 70s, when everybody, even in a market like Los Angeles, where you could use a coat hanger to receive 17 channels, that people had antenna rotators on their televisions. Maybe for that, but I think it was like more for getting rid of ghosting images than it was to bring in the DX.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a real world, you know, problem to be solved. Of course, it's no longer an issue really anymore with, you know, with the digital technologies that are used. But it was very interesting, and my first, you know, kind of major project there. And then later on, I got involved in the videotext and teletext business, again at Zenith, because they were interested in whether or not they should build teletext decoders into their TV sets. And so that was very interesting, and got to work with a bunch of people over in Europe where teletext was a big, big and popular thing. And then advanced, Zenith started up a cable TV coder equipment division, and I went to work in that area. And that's kind of what got me into cable TV for the first time.
And that was what, a set-top box for premium content?
Yes, it was called ZTAC, the Zenith Tiered Addressable Converter. And it had analog scrambling technique, and it was addressable, so you could control which channels, you would or wouldn't descramble. And Zenith was very successful for several years selling those decoders into the cable TV industry.
Well, I remember in 1972, the family was living in San Diego, and I think it was Cox Cable out there. They had a set-top box for premium content that had a plastic card that went in the top.
Sure. Well, there were security cards, in some of those systems. That's where the security, technology was held. I mean, there's, obviously been a lot of vendors that have come and gone building equipment for the cable TV industry. One of the reasons that Zenith was so successful was, they were an upstart into the industry. They were not well established.
They weren't a Magnavox or RCA.
Yeah, in the cable TV industry. In fact, myself and another buddy were the first ones to exhibit at the National Cable TV Association supporting Zenith. It was just very much in the startup phase. We rented a van in Chicago and put all the equipment and stuff in it that we were going to demo, drove it down to Dallas and set up, kind of on some tables in the convention center. And people would come by and they'd say, "Zenith, are you the same Zenith that makes TVs?" Because we were very low key, very startup, in our display, right? It didn't look like a big major consumer electronics company when we got started there.
Right. The National Cable Television Association conventions, the vendors there paid tens of thousands of dollars for displays. You had your folding table?
Yeah, and they had very nice professional displays. And, we were kind of like, again, like a startup, even though we were within a, very large company at the time. After that, of course, we joined the rest of the big boys with our displays.
Was it the same Zenith in Chicago that bought Heathkit?
Yes, it was. In fact, I was still there when they did that. I went over to Benton Harbor a couple times because somehow I was involved with some of the computer stuff they were doing. And it was kind of like going to Mecca, in a sense of Heathkits, right? I built Heathkits, Benton Harbor, I went there. And of course, the whole place was very underwhelming, very industrial and everything else. But it was cool to go to the factory and, talk to some people and see what they were doing.
Yeah, but it created a whole generation of builders, I think.
Yes.
It was so well done, don't you think, in terms of the documentation, the manuals, everything? It was just so well done.
Absolutely. I mean, I think everything I ever built worked the first time. Just because I was very, very careful and precise, right? Not because I necessarily knew exactly what I was doing, but I followed those directions precisely and it worked.
Now, you mentioned that you'd gotten into, as a result of being in Zenith, that you started to get into microprocessors and microcontrollers. And I remember that period of time, it's like the mid-70s. We were at the 4044, the 8088, the Z80 processor. What did you get involved in and at what level? And where did it go from there?
So I was around 1976. Again, I was still at my first job. I was out in Silicon Valley, and someone I knew from college was working at Intel. And he was actually working in the QA department at Intel. And he took me there for an after-hours, personal tour. And we went to his cubicle, and there was a bucket of chips under his desk. I'm like, "What's that?" And he said to me, "Well, that's $1 million worth of failed 8008s. And so, you know, this was when Apple Computer was starting up and MITS and, you know, all those companies. And there was something called the Homebrew Computer Club, which was a club of enthusiasts that held monthly meetings. And I went to a bunch of those meetings, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, Steve Jobs and Wozniak were there showing off Apple Ones, you know, everything else. It was an amazing, cool time. So that got me interested in, you know, using a microprocessor for something useful within the amateur radio community. And so a friend of mine, Steve, his caller's N9IP now, he and I worked together and we wrote some software to decode Morse code using a, I think it was a 4040, Intel 4040 microprocessor. Well, that led to actually a series of articles that was published in QST magazine, August, September, October 1976, called Meet the Microprocessor. And it was the first article in the magazine that talked about microprocessors, first time it had been exposed through the magazine. And I showed you this earlier. We actually won the cover award for that series. And as I was saying to you, what's interesting about this cover award is it's an actual printing plate that was used to print the cover of that issue of the magazine. So rather unusual because you wouldn't get something like that today, even with an award. That was fun. And also wrote a couple of articles for 73 magazine in the same vintage. And by the way, our Morse code decoder, I mean, it worked, but it wasn't probably as sophisticated as the software ones that you can get today, certainly.
I remember projects with the 4040, with the 4004. The way that you loaded those, you had toggle switches on the data bus, and you kind of put the code in one byte at a time.
You know, I'm trying to remember the exact development environment we used. At there was also there was a way that you could store your program on an audio tape and modulate and demodulate.
Right, Radio Shack did that with their first computer.
Yeah, and in fact, when I went to work at Zenith, and we were working with microprocessors, we felt initially very lucky because the Texas Instrument had a programming console that used some kind of, I think, digital cartridge tapes or something. So we would put it on tapes. And of course, we also used the paper tape, the famous paper tape, you know, for programming. And then after a year or two, we got 8-inch floppy disks. And we thought, you know, we had been delivered, right? That was the ultimate for programming.
And you got a hard disk, 10 megabyte hard disk.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, and it was funny when I worked at Zenith. Another thing I remember was in an R&D lab was the test equipment that I had at my bench cost more than my house.
I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we had an HP this and a something that, and you know, it was, and we were in. Zenith had a number of locations around Chicago. We were in what was called Plant One because it was the original Zenith building on the west side of Chicago. And even when I was there, this was a very old building. And we would come in after a weekend, and sometimes sections of the ceiling had fallen down onto our desks. But we had $50,000 HP Spectrum analyzers.
And now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQL I/O networking lounges all of the time and Academy resources, including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today. What happened to Zenith in the end?
Well, the story would be that the Japanese, when they entered the television market...
That would be Sony Trinitron was the competitor.
Yeah, Sony and a couple other Japanese brands, they used predatory pricing to lowball the price of their TVs. And in fact, this went... This was a major court case that came out of this, and ultimately the government basically said, well, we don't want to pursue this any further because we want to keep a good relationship with Japan, you know, for import-export. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end. You know, Zenith moved manufacturing to Mexico. They did all kinds of other things to reduce costs, but eventually they just... couldn't compete. Now, the company ended up, long after I left, being acquired by LG Electronics, of course, one of the Korean companies. And it still exists as kind of a U.S.-based R&D facility.
For LG?
Yeah, for LG. It doesn't do any of the manufacturing.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. And there were, I'll tell you this, some of the engineers that I met at Zenith still today, I remember as being some of the smartest, most amazing folks I ever met in my career. They were just, you know, they were building TVs, but they were top of their field, you know, in terms of technology and everything else. And, you know, kind of inspired me along the way.
The quality goes in before the name goes on.
Exactly.
Yes, I remember all of those jingles. Okay, so what happened after you left Zenith?
So I went to work. It turns out my boss at Zenith went to work for a cable television company in Denver. So I was in the Chicago area working at Zenith, and he recruited me to come out and work in an R&D lab that they had set up to support the cable television company. It was called American Television Communications, ATC, eventually ended up being sold into the Time Warner Cable family. And we worked on a number of R&D projects. We worked primarily with Toshiba as the potential manufacturer. Toshiba was not established in the cable TV industry as an equipment vendor, but wanted to get into the industry. So we had, you know, three or four different projects going with them.
They wanted into the set-top box business.
Yeah, they wanted to get into set-top box. They wanted, one of the projects was actually an outside of the home's scrambling control system so that the installers would not have to go into the home, and you know, didn't even need a set-top box in the home. But the project I worked on was interesting. When I was there is when the compact discs or CDs first came out. And of course, everyone was raving about the quality of the music that you got off the CDs. So the idea was, let's figure out a way to transmit digital audio on the cable system all the way into your home, into a special purpose set-top box. And the name of that project was DCAT, Digital Cable Audio Terminal. And working with Toshiba, we actually built the head-end equipment. We built the terminals. We tested it actually here in a northern Denver suburb in a real cable plant. It all worked. And then one day, the business people from the other building came over and said to us, "We can't figure out how to make money on this project. We're just going to cancel it." And that was the end of it.
Well, parenthetically, I should tell you, and you know this already, that American Television Communications was founded by Monroe Rifkin, Monty Rifkin. I actually knew him because my office was next door to his at Rifkin and Associates, where I worked in the cable television business. And apparently, he got so tired of going to New York City to practically defend the company on Wall Street that he decided to sell it off to Time Warner so that he could go back into private practice, which is what he did at Rifkin and Associates. So it's funny how small this industry was, but the reason that I live in Israel is because of Monroe Rifkin, because he shared the stock with every employee in the company at Rifkin and Associates, even the lady who answered the telephone.
Yeah, you know, Denver was pretty much the capital of cable back in that era.
They invented the industry. He and Bill Daniels.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Turned it from a remote antenna business.
Exactly.
Into major corporations.
Well, you know, CATV stood for Community Antenna TV.
Right.
And so that, like you said, it started off being a little community thing, you know, put an antenna up on the hill so we can sell TV sets down in the town.
I think Bill Daniels, I think he was up in Wyoming, as I recall, right?
Yeah.
He wanted either football games or fights or something like that, and able to be able to watch them from Cheyenne or someplace like that. So the business started as one man's need to watch television he couldn't get, and it all kind of avalanched from there.
Yeah.
It was a great business in those days.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't seem like it's a great business anymore.
It's different. I mean, it's evolved and it's different for sure.
Well, you are a cable television pioneer, cable TV pioneer, right? You received this award. Could you explain a little bit about what that means to our audience?
Yeah, so it's an honorary award. There's an organization, the Cable TV Pioneers, and they select maybe 10 to 15 people a year through a nomination and review process. And they honor people that have, you know, contributed to the industry. You could be in marketing, you could be in sales, you could be on the hardware side, you could be on the operator side. They go across the whole spectrum of you know, roles in the industry. And they hold an annual banquet. It was here in Denver this past year. Beautiful gala banquet. You know, they parade out all the people that are getting the awards, and you know, it's a big social thing for sure. Chance to get together and with people maybe you haven't seen in a while, but it's also a legitimate honor because they really do review the applications. You have to be nominated by two existing members, and so you know, I'm pleased to have gotten that. The people that nominated me actually, you know, again, worked in the industry and knew me back all the way back from the teletext days at Zenith. And then of course had followed me through my career. And I'll say my major contribution to the industry, was actually the last 25 years of my career, where I worked and managed development of electronic program guides. And, you know, these are the program guides that are on your cable or satellite box. And I was actually one of the first employees of a joint venture between News Corporation and TCI. So this was a 50-50 joint venture between Rupert Murdoch and John Malone. And Rupert Murdoch owned TV Guide magazine, part of his publishing domain. And of course, John Malone wanted to build out digital cable. And he knew that these digital cable boxes that would have, you know, hundreds of channels on them needed some kind of program guide. So this joint venture was formed between TV Guide as the experts here in the U.S. on television programming and guidance, and TCI, because they wanted to have a guide on their set top. And of course, back then, the cable TV boxes, even those that the digital boxes, had very minimal compute and display capabilities. In fact, the space that we had to write our program in was about 350K of memory. Okay. Our entire guide had to fit in 350K of memory, and we had 750K to hold all the television listings programs. And I'll tell you, without doing the math, this was very hard. This was very hard. And so it was quite an engineering accomplishment, you know, that my team pulled off to develop this guide. And it launched in 1996, along with the digital cable boxes. The guide that we developed back then, obviously, you know, it was improved and evolved over the years. And it's still in use today in the cable TV industry on some of the older cable TV boxes. So however many years later that is, you know, 25, 30 years later, that guide is still running. In at one point, the guide was running in 40 million households. And over the, you know, over the lifetime of that guide, for our company that built the guides, it generated over $1 billion of revenue just from a little program guide.
What was interesting about that industry, the digital was difficult to implement for smaller cable television systems. So the industry, I think, including Malone, I think there was a joint venture between TCI and Liberty and maybe a few other of the big ones, and they created the product called HITS. Do you remember that?
I was going to mention, because we were part of that whole program. Also, TCI, when it wanted to roll out digital cable, of course, it mostly owned small cable systems at the time. And they had a program that they put together called TCI 500. And the goal was to roll out equipment to 500 cable head ends within like a year. So it was an amazing program. And we were developing the guide as part of that program. And they told us that we could not have any equipment at those head ends to support our guide. All the data and software had to be delivered over satellite, you know, into the, it was a Motorola digital system and everything else. So we actually developed what we called the national feed, which was a data feed that included all the listings data for the entire country and all the configuration data that each local head end needed to configure the guide. That was a really an amazing accomplishment. And of course, you had to design this thing so that it didn't take 3 hours for the box to get all its data and start up after it was installed in the house. So it was a very sophisticated set of carouseled data, some carousels running every few minutes, some running every 15 minutes, some running every couple hours. Again, quite an amazing accomplishment in its day.
It brings back great memories. I was the HITS czar at Rifkin & Associates. And what that meant was, is we had a bunch of 330 megahertz, 30-channel systems across the Midwest. As we upgraded to 450 megahertz, what does that give us? What, 60 channels?
Mm-hmm.
We actually were able to use a couple of those channels for hits. And so what we got from hits is every head end got this rack. You unpacked it. You plugged it in. It was amazing. It just worked. And then you start rolling out these digital set-top boxes. Now you have 300 channels. It was revolutionary for these small towns. Centralia, Illinois comes to mind, or Mount Vernon, Illinois comes to mind, as places where we put these systems in first. We also put the first cable modems into these systems in 1998-99. They were ATM modems from COM21 at the time, but it was like, and it was the industry that working together, you know, even though they might have been competitors, we weren't competitors in the same markets. I had a very good friend in Denver who happened to be the banker of all these guys. He says, you'd have to kill me because I couldn't tell you what was going on in these rooms. But he says, at the NCTA, you get Malone and you get Rifkin and you get all these guys, Daniels, get all these guys together. They're all smoking cigars and they're all deciding what project they could do together. And HITS was one of those projects.
Yeah, and it's hard to appreciate the scale of that project, right? Hundreds and hundreds of head ends getting equipped. As you said, it was a turnkey installation. They'd ship the equipment, you'd turn it on, it pretty much worked.
The documentation was amazing. The training was amazing. They all came together, and it was amazing.
You know, we played our role with the program guide, but, you know, General Instruments, General Instruments, then Motorola, did an amazing job of building, you know, all that equipment. I mean, that was very, very impressive.
That was a great illustration of how an industry could work together. I mean, I realize that perhaps it looked like these were all monopolies in these areas, and they were. I mean, you couldn't afford to build out Centralia, Illinois, if you were overbuilding another cable TV provider because you couldn't make the numbers work. And the cable TV business up to that point was a pure numbers game.
Yep.
And if you didn't have the numbers, you didn't play. That was one of the great lessons I learned from Monty Rifkin, that my customer wasn't the guy in Centralia, it was the Bank of Boston, who wanted 13.5% cash flow growth every year out of the system, or they'd want their money back. It was a great business. It was a lot of fun. We need to get to amateur radio at some point, but I think that one of the great things I find about talking to people like you on QSO Today, we don't realize the roles that ham radio operators play in the things that we use every day that we take for granted, like the program guide.
Yeah, and also we've kind of skipped over, you know, after I left ATC, I went to work at Nielsen, the TV ratings company.
Really?
And I was head of the engineering department at Nielsen that built all the equipment that, you know, we put in people's homes to do the overnight ratings.
That was a set-top box that would record all the channels that you were on and how long you stayed on each channel and stuff like that?
Yeah, it was interesting because part of the Nielsen, you know, research strategy was that they did not introduce a new piece of equipment into the home that the users needed to manipulate. They didn't want to affect how they used the equipment. So instead, they came up with various devices that attached to the existing equipment, including VCRs, including cable boxes, including your TV, including your game console if you had one.
And they gave you a very nice remote.
And the whole point was it was supposed to be, you know, in the background and not affecting the consumer's use of these devices. So the actual, when a Nielsen home was wired up, it took 1 or 2 days to put all that equipment in place. Because literally, like on the VCR, you'd have to disassemble the VCR somewhat to put a special probe in that picked up the local oscillator frequency of the tuner so you could tell what channel they were recording, things like that. In fact, there's famous stories of, you know, there'd be two installers and one of them would go with the lady of the house into the kitchen and have coffee while the other one was taking the VCR apart so that she wouldn't see what was going on.
Karen and I had, for a short time, about a year or two, we actually had one of these boxes. And I don't know whether it was Nielsen, but it was one of the companies. And the reason we agreed is because we didn't have a remote control on our television. So it allowed us to control a television, but every once in a while it asked us if we were still watching.
The equipment evolved over the years, and now it's much more of a passive monitoring system. They don't have to take any equipment apart to do any of that. But it was a fascinating business to be in. I'll just point out one thing. So Nielsen is a very successful big business. Half of its customers were advertisers and advertising agencies. The other half were the programmers, okay? And of course, the programmers wanted high ratings so that, you know, they could attract the advertising. The advertisers, you know, didn't really want higher ratings, right? Because then they'd have to pay more for placing their ads. And so every time Nielsen made some subtle adjustment in the measurement technique that might affect the ratings, half of their customers were unhappy. It might be a different half, but half of them were unhappy. So, you know, companies all the time were complaining about how Nielsen wasn't getting it right.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. So let's talk a little bit about ham radio. Where was ham radio playing through this whole time? Were you always active?
You know, I think I had the typical raising a family, you know, job hopping thing where, you know, I would set up, you know, as we moved around, I'd set up kind of a modest little station at the house that I was living at, you know, wherever I was living. I would do some operating, but I wasn't very serious and very engaged with it. It was really probably only within the last 10 to 15 years that I really got back into ham radio. Now, I kept my license alive and all that. Where I really got back in, I got some better equipment. I set up antennas. I started operating contests and chasing awards and doing all that stuff, including the most recent time we moved to Denver. We lived in Evergreen, which is up in the foothills, and I did not have an HOA where I lived, so I was able to put up like a hex beam and some, you know, some big dipole antennas and things, and also a 6-meter beam, and I became quite infatuated with working 6 meters, in fact.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed in researching our discussion today, you are quite active in 6 meters, and you just showed me before we started that you had your iPad running on your remote station and that you were doing some meteor scatter on 6 meters remotely on your iPad. But one of the things I noticed in doing this research is that there's something called JTA alert. Is that somehow connected to 6 meters?
Yes, absolutely. So for folks that operate the digital modes, the kind of the pioneer program on all that is WSJTX. You know, everyone that operates the digital modes is familiar with that program or derivatives of that program. And it's a nice software and it, you know, helps you make the contacts, of, you know, has all the appropriate automation in it. But another companion program was written many years ago by VK3 AMA Lori called JT Alert. And if you couple JT Alert with the WSJTX software, you have a very nice system that helps track all the stations that you've worked previously. You can set up various alerts like a new grid on 6 meters or a new country on 10 meters. and it will generate audio alerts. It'll say, you know, if you're trying to work all states, it'll say new state or something. I know it come right out of your speaker, right? You run over to the radio and you try and work them. Well, that's great, but believe it or not, we don't all sit in front of our radios 24 hours a day, you know, waiting for that new DX contact or new state or new grid on 6 meters. So there's been, you know, the need to maybe send you a text message or an email when, you know, these alerts are generated. And within JT Alert, there is a mode that you can enable that will generate a message, but you have to complete the technology that then sends that as a text or email. It's not completely built into the software. So you have to do some configuration. You have to, you know, create, a little program that runs and everything else. And this has proven to be somewhat difficult for a lot of hams to do because it requires, you know, some PC skills that they may not have.
And working with SMTP forwarding, things like that, you wrote like a 12-page introduction on how to configure.
Yeah, so I wrote up a complete document, step by step, shows every screenshot that you're going to run into where you set up a special Gmail account, which is, of course, free, and that's how you route these messages and how you configure it to send an email or send a text to your phone. And published that a few months ago and have gotten tremendously positive feedback from people. I mean, people that have tried to follow other sets of directions to do this and have failed would send me emails saying, I can't believe it. I followed your directions and it worked the first time and it's still working.
My wife's an English teacher and she says, you know, the first exercise you always do is describe in writing how to make a peanut butter sandwich. It's the same kind of thing, right? People think that they're writing a step-by-step, but they need to follow their step-by-step by the word in order to make it right. It looks to me like you got it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Why did I do that? Well, because I had done it myself, you know, a couple of years ago, figured out a way, you know, how to do this. And I would mention it from time to time, you know, in some of the forums, and people started asking me, well, how did you do this? And I said, you know, I think I need to just write it up very carefully, you know, not just give a shoot from the hip with an answer. And again, I've been very pleased with, the positive response I've gotten back from that.
The fact that you're able to operate 6 meters, a meteor scatter, off of your iPad, how are you doing that?
So I have what we would call a remote station. So all of my ham radio equipment is located actually at another ham's house, and I do not have any equipment at my current house. I have all the equipment there. It's all connected to a computer. All the equipment has a desktop application. For example, I use Win4ICOM to control my ICOM 7600. I have an Elecraft amplifier and antenna tuner, and they have desktop applications. Of course, this is all Windows environment. So everything that I need to do to operate my station is on the desktop or the screens of the computer at that location. And then I use a remote desktop program. I use Splashtop in my case to connect in, and I'm able to operate the full station, you know, as if I was sitting in front of the screens that are actually physically at the station. And I've operated that station, you know, from all kinds of different locations around the country, in hotel rooms, in vacation rentals, etc. And what's nice about the Splashtop program is, in addition to running on a PC, it'll also run on an iPad or an iPhone. In fact, I have a little story to tell about that. So we spend a month in Crested Butte, Colorado every summer, and, you know, beautiful Colorado location up in the mountains. I was out riding my bicycle one day, and I got one of these text alerts for a new grid on 6 meters. So I rolled back down the hill a little bit to where there was a better cell phone signal, and I connected using my cell phone and worked the station while I was out riding my bicycle. And so, you know, that wouldn't have happened, of course, without everything that we've already talked about.
It's my understanding from a presentation that you've made to other radio clubs, and I have a link to that on the show notes page, that you've actually used this remote station from all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, any place that I can get a good internet connection, doesn't have to be high-end, just a good internet connection, I can operate. You know, the other comment I'll make is I'm very fortunate about the situation of where my remote station is located, in that it's, as I mentioned, at another ham's house. He's on the west side of Denver, and he has a contest caliber set of antennas. He has a 90-foot tower, 120-foot tower, top to bottom filled with aluminum, as they say. And so, you know, it's well known that once you have a reasonably good radio, you should spend all the rest of your money on putting up better antennas, right? Buying a $10,000 radio instead of a $2,000 radio on a dipole is not going to make, you know, a big difference. But spending $10,000 on your antennas could make a huge difference. And so this is actually, this remote station is the best station I've ever operated in my life. And it's all about the antennas.
And the nice thing about that station, it's not 50 miles away. If you need to go fix it.
Yeah, because it's at a ham's house. If it's something simple like the rotator isn't powered up for some reason, you know, he just goes and flips the switch, right? Because he also uses the same equipment. He's a contester. He uses it during contests. So sometimes something gets disconnected, you know, and he doesn't remember to reconnect it for me.
You guys have a schedule between you in terms of when you like to operate? Are your operating modes completely different?
You know, they're fairly different in that he's had this station for a long time. He's, you know, worked all the DXCC he needs to work. He loves the major contests, okay? And in particular, he's a Cracker Jack SO2R CW operator. So he'll do those contests, and I'm fine with that. What he told me early on was because he knew I operated a lot of 6 meters from there, and we've got two different 6 meter beam antennas, is he said, let me know if there's an opening to Europe. There's still a couple countries in Europe I haven't worked on 6 meters yet. Otherwise, basically, I can go on anytime I want and use the station because he's off doing other things to keep himself busy, except during the contest weekends.
And when you're operating, do you use your own call sign?
Absolutely, yeah.
So nobody would know that you're not operating from your own home station.
That's right. In fact, if you go on my QRZ page, I'm very open about operating a remote station, and that's where I operate from. And I have my, you know, my grid square coordinates on QRZ are where the station is located, not where my house is located.
I see that you're on the Grant Advisory Committee for the Amateur Radio Digital Communications of the ARDC. That's a volunteer position. What does that responsibility entail?
Yeah, so let me give you just a little minute or two background on ARDC for folks that may not know what that is. So ARDC stands for Amateur Radio Digital Communications, and it's a very thoughtful title because the foundation, and it's a nonprofit foundation, supports amateur radio projects and digital communications projects that, you know, have some intersection with the amateur radio hobby. It's been in existence for 3 to 4 years now only, so it's a fairly new organization. It has a large grant that started the organization. Approves grants worth about $5 to $6 million a year in the hobby. And the grants that it approves kind of fall into four categories. One is what we call amateur radio. So that's something like a club says, hey, I need to upgrade my repeater system, or I need to expand my repeater system, or a club station, you know, needs new antennas because they're 30 years old and falling down, right? Or, you know, some kind of a emergency communications facility that, you know, ham radio is involved with. Another category is what we call education. So it's all about educating and trying to encourage people to get into the hobby. You know, so it's a local club that needs some funding to hold classes or something like that. Then there's an R&D category, and this is where some of these digital communications projects come in. So we help fund projects like M17 and MMDVM and things like that. We may not be the only funding source, but we fund projects. And we also funded an interesting project, another organization I'm involved with. Actually, this funding occurred before I joined ARDC as a volunteer, and we're helping to put up a new building to support a 60-foot dish antenna that's owned by a ham club here in Colorado. And then the last category is scholarships. So we support scholarship programs. We do this in coordination with several entities. The most major, of course, is the ARRL and their scholarship program. So we're a major contributor into them. We do not manage the scholarships. We just fund the entities that provide the scholarships. And so that's what the organization does. And, you know, occasionally it gets in the headlines when, you know, a significant grant is approved. The process for approving grants, it's formalized. So the grants come in, they're reviewed by some staff member first to make sure that they have all the appropriate, you know, elements to support the request. Then it goes to what's called the Grant Advisory Committee, and there's a dozen volunteers plus a chairperson, and we're split up nominally into three groups, the amateur radio education and R&D groups. The projects are routed to us, and we review the projects and make recommendations. And then there's a voting process that occurs, and, you know, things are approved or they're not approved. Sometimes we want to ask for more information. And this process has been honed over a couple of years now to be quite efficient and effective. After our recommendations are put together, it then goes to the board of directors for final approval. And they generally approve what we have recommended. Sometimes they'll make a few tweaks here and there. They ultimately control the purse strings, so they have to make a decision each year on, you know, how much money the foundation's gonna spend. This is my first year just finished up on the committee. It has been a wonderful activity. After I retired in 2018, you know, I was, like a lot of folks, looking for some kind of volunteer activity that I could do to stay connected in a community. And this came up, and I applied and got approved to the committee. The other committee members are from all over the country and internationally, because ARDC also supports international projects. It's not just U.S. Or North American based. The other people on the committee, it's a very diverse group. We have people with a variety of different backgrounds and interests in ham radio and level of knowledge. Some people are MCOM experts. Some people are like experts on satellites, you know, all over the place. So the reviews are always very interesting. The conversations are very interesting. And we reach a consensus, you know, and it's all run in a very managed fashion. And I've been thrilled to be a part of that this year and, you know, feel pride in helping to fund all these worthwhile projects.
It's an amazing resource for amateur radio. On the one hand, when people think that amateur radio is through, and unfortunately, I think there's a lot of hams, older hams, that think that amateur radio is through. But amateur radio, as I've said on this show many times, is the most interesting thing happening in the world, I think, from a technology standpoint, in terms of just the width and breadth of projects that people are doing and technologies that they're developing in their garages. It almost kind of takes me back to the 50s, 60s, and 70s when whole industries were being born out of garages.
I will admit that before I got involved in ARDC, I was probably falling a little bit into that category about worrying about the hobby and, you know, my age and everyone, you know, a lot of the clubs I'm at, most of the people are my age. But boy, you're right. Once I got exposed to the kind of projects and proposals that were coming in, I felt much more positive about the future of the hobby and all the activities that we have.
I'm feeling pretty good about it at this point. Maybe it's taken 480 episodes of the QSO Today podcast. No, I'm actually feeling it's in very good hands. We don't have the kids on the one hand, but I think that the kids could be 35 years old. We're living well into our 70s and 80s these days, or longer.
You know, one of the things that I think is really critical for the future of the hobby is local clubs.
Right.
And I'm involved in several clubs here in the Denver area. The one that's actually closest to my house, called the Parker Radio Association, or PRA, is a very high energy, high activity club. Part of that is because it has managed to attract people, you know, in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, right? Not just those of us that are 60s and 70s and 80s. And like, there's a build project every month. There's all kinds of outings that are done. If a new ham comes and joins the club, we have equipment, good equipment. We'll loan them so they can get on the air. We have a little committee. They'll go over to their house and help them set up their first antenna. It's just a wonder to watch all of this. And it happens at the local level, right? With your other operators in the community.
Well, I also think, you know, with the demise of service clubs, you know, like, remember Kiwanis and all of these clubs, that these local clubs play a big part of socializing with other human beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's one of the things that they should be advertising. If they're not a club that doesn't welcome new members, but if it's a club that welcomes new members at the door, then it creates an opportunity for socializing that people are pining for.
Yeah, no, we have this club holds two meetings a month, and we get about 50 people at each meeting.
You're a member of the Deep Space Exploration Society. What is that, and how do you participate?
Yeah, so that's a club that's made up of both amateur radio operators and radio astronomy fans. The DSES group owns a 60-foot dish in rural southeast Colorado. The dish was originally built in the 1950s, 1960s by the U.S. government for some form of unspecified propagation studies that we think were related to the dew line, you know, a self-defense system. So the dish was built, you know, the government used it for many years. They sort of, abandoned the site, and it was given to another organization in the 60s. And then finally that organization ended up giving it to this club was formed. And the dish had not been, the time the club was formed, I think the dish had not moved in like 30 or 40 years. And so it took a couple years for the club to refurbish the dish and get it working again. And they've done that. I think I mentioned maybe before we were talking a little bit about ARDC. They actually got a grant from ARDC to put up a new building on the site because they do a lot of amateur radio activities on the site. There's also an HF remote station there. This location is amazing. It's in rural southeast Colorado. When you stand on the site, you can look in any direction and all you see is the horizon.
Nice and quiet, very quiet place.
Very, very quiet location. They have commercial power and internet at the site. So it's a quite functional location. The as I said, there's a 60-foot dish, which we do. We obviously do EME on it, right? We do Earth, Moon, Earth communications on it. And, you know, with that dish, we have a pretty good signal.
Can that be done remotely? I mean, it seems to me in order to create a large number of people around that project, that to build a remote station that runs the dish, maybe you sign up for hours, but you log into it. Are they doing something like that?
So the first remote functionality at the site is for the HF station that they have there. And by the way, it's a really interesting section of land there. When the dish was first built, they built an underground bunker to go with it. And this is one of these things, you walk in there, you think you're in an X-Files movie or, you know, TV show or something, right? It is 50s, 60s era underground bunker. And that's actually where the HF station is located right now. It's a bit away from the dish, and we have some towers and antennas and things, and that is remotely accessible right now. The plan, once we finish the new building, is that we will have remote operation for the big dish as long as there is someone on site who is able to monitor the dish movement to make sure that something bad doesn't happen. You know, it's a mechanical monster, to say the least, right? It's computer controlled. We have a specialized software that was written. So, for example, when we're doing EME contest, you know, we pointed at the moon. Let's say the moon is up all day, for example, okay? We pointed at the moon, and it automatically tracks the moon for the rest of the day. We don't have to do anything in terms of pointing the antenna. There's never been the ability to operate remotely. So it's about a three-hour drive from Denver down to the site. A lot of the members in Colorado Springs, it's more like a two-hour drive for them. But you don't go down there every day, right? And so, for example, during an EME contest in the future, we'll have some people on site and then some people that operate the station remotely at the same time. And there's a lot of other science activities that are done there. They do pulsar monitoring. They do JOBE. They do this, that, and the other. We're, you know, trying to get some of the colleges and local high schools involved. You know, we're very plugged into the local rural community down there. They call it the birdbath, the local community, because the position that the dish is left in when it's not being used is pointing straight up, because that's minimum wind resistance on the dish. So from a distance, it looks like a giant birdbath.
What excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now?
You know, I think I like to operate. I enjoy contests, but I like projects. So I think the fact that our local club is doing a lot of projects, this deep space exploration is doing a lot of projects, the ARDC is doing a lot of projects, and it's pulling people in, it's educating and training them and getting them excited about the hobby. So I like all kind of the various development type activities that are going on right now.
I think it's amazing. Do you have advice that you would give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Well, I think for returning hams, I would say, you know, if you've been gone for like 20 years, it's not what it was like 20 years ago. You know, sure, there's still sideband contests or something, right? I mean, that hasn't changed, or CW contests. But the introduction of technology into the hobby, whether it's the ability to do remote stations or all the amazing digital communication modes. I mean, we have this local club that I go to, but we have a weekly lunch. About 20 people show up every week for lunch. And half the time they're talking about, you know, the little wire antenna in their backyard and the DX they just worked using FT8 on 10 meters, which wouldn't have happened without all these, you know, digital modes really extending the reach of a very modest station so you can make, you know, you can have worldwide communications.
Right. It's very exciting. So what would you say then to that returning ham? What would your advice be?
Well, my advice would be to spend a little money, buy one of the modern transceivers. Don't mess around with something that's 10 or 20 years old. Get a modern transceiver. They're marvelous to use. You can easily set up and use all the digital modes, put up, you know, some modest antenna and get on the air, right? Get on the air and start playing around with all these things. Plus, I would say, you know, find your local club and go to the local club and get involved.
And a new ham, maybe the same?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much the same thing. In their case, probably the first thing is find that local club and see if you can, you know, get some mentorship. You know, stuff that I completely take for granted as I understand this, right? Like a dipole antenna, right? Okay, yes, they passed their exam, but they're like, I don't know what a dipole, I don't know how to put up a dipole antenna. I don't know how to connect it. You know, can I use coax? Do I need a ground rod? I mean, simple stuff. If they can get some, more experienced hams to help them out, they can get on the air and have a good first experience, not have a bad first experience.
I think that's wonderful advice, especially since there's so many of us who can be mentors and are just looking for somebody to, a mentee.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll admit, I love the social aspects of ham radio. Maybe more so because I'm retired now and I don't have a daily job that I go to with all its inherent good and bad social aspects, right? I enjoy the meetings, the luncheons, the, working with folks on a project. I help maintain, some websites and things just to, keep things moving forward.
Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I know there's other stuff that we could have talked about, that you are a hound for old equipment and you have a garage full, at least. But we'll have to get to that at some other point. But I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast and wish you 73.
Thank you very much, and 73 back to you.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Bill. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in WT0DX in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.